argument of today, and I would like to greet the Court with Class groups that are here this morning. We have students from Columbus High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. Won't you be seated? And we have students from Tri-County High School. Would they stand, please? And welcome to you all, too. Won't you be seated? We're delighted that these schools are participating with the Courts and State Bar's Court with Class program. The students have gotten summaries of the case they're about to hear. There are additional summaries out on the table in the foyer. Now that we have met you, I'd like to introduce the court to you. To my far left, Justice Patrick Crux. In the empty chair is usually Justice Jeanine Geske. She is at home recuperating, and with our high technology system, she can hear us on the phone. Justice Geske, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
I don't know if you could hear her, but she said, yes, good morning. And if she wants to ask a question, we will relay it to counsel if they cannot hear her. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right, Justice John Wilcox. And to his right, and the far right of the bench, is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With introductions made, we will proceed to call the case 96-2243 CR State v. Meyer, and representing the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Stephen Kleinmeier. Mr. Kleinmeier, you may state your appearance, and then I would like to convey a message to you about the nature of the oral argument. This will affect your oral argument, Mr. Hahn, also. Mr. Kleinmeier.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General. I'm representing the state of Wisconsin, the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner in this case.
Mr. Kleinmeier, you have several issues set forth in your brief. We would like you to argue what I think in your brief is the last issue, namely whether this case should be remanded to the trial court to take evidence on the issue of reasonable suspicion, and if it were remanded, what would the instructions to the trial court be as to the nature of the evidence and its ruling? In other words, how do we interpret the Richards decision from the United States Supreme Court? The court would like you to deal with that issue, or those two issues first, probably not longer than 15 minutes, and then go on to the other two issues.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If that's all right with you.
Yes. Of course, the state would request remand only if we lose on one of the first two issues. But if we get to that point, then we think remand would be appropriate because, as decided by the Court of Appeals, the Richards versus Wisconsin standard applies. And Richards versus Wisconsin, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the blanket rule, where this court said you could always make a no-knock entry if it's a search warrant for drug dealing or possession of intent to deliver. And at Richards, it's a reasonable suspicion test. Police can make a no-knock entry if they have reasonable suspicion to believe that announcing will result in danger to them or the destruction of the evidence. We think if the first two issues remand, it would be appropriate because if we're going to apply the test of Richards versus Wisconsin, the state should be provided an opportunity to meet that test. Obviously, when this case was back in the trial court, the search was in, I believe, November 1995. I don't know the exact date of judgment of conviction, but the appeal was pending in the Court of Appeals. Briefs have been filed at the time the Richards versus Wisconsin decision was issued. So the state has never had an opportunity or never had a reason to introduce evidence that would be directed to the reasonable suspicion test in Richards versus Wisconsin.
Well, Mr. Kleinmeier, the particular concern, I believe, that the court has, if we do that, assuming that we get to this, is that when we remand it, exactly what is the test? What is the standard that's been enunciated in Richards? As I read your brief, you seem to say that it's a two-part test. First of all, that a no-knock is okay if, one, the police experience in similar cases supports the suspicion, and, two, there is nothing in the particular case that negates the suspicion. Is that essentially what your position is?
Yes.
Now, first of all, with respect to the first item of analysis, i.e., the police experience in similar cases, is particularized knowledge with respect to the particular defendants necessary? Let's assume there is nothing in the case that negates, to negate the suspicion. In other words, the police believe it's in the house and that the people are in the house, the drug dealers are in the house. It's not in some barn someplace where nobody is in danger of anything and the evidence isn't going to be destructive. But all of the police know is that there is drug dealing going on in that house, or they have a reasonable suspicion. Now, do they have to have particularized suspicion that these people are in and of themselves dangerous, or that they have a particular propensity to destroy evidence?
No, they don't. If their experience or training in regard to similar kind of cases would allow them to infer that there would be danger or the destruction of evidence, in this case, they're allowed, I think, justified in making the no-knock entry. And I base that primarily, since the test is reasonable suspicion, and in adopting reasonable suspicion as a test, the U.S. Supreme Court said this is a much easier test for the state than probable cause. And they cited Terry v. Ohio as one of the reasons, of course, for reasonable suspicion, the stop and frisk case. And I think for guidance in this, how to apply the reasonable suspicion test, we can look to stop and frisk cases where the test is reasonable suspicion. And frankly, I think the best case to start looking is Terry v. Ohio, the original stop and frisk case.
Well, let's just look at Richards, okay? On page 1420 of 117 Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court said, quote, accordingly, the court, referring to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, determined that police in Wisconsin don't need specific information about dangerousness or the possible destruction of drugs in a particular case in order to dispense with the knock and announce requirement in felony drug cases, right?
I see it now.
Okay, that's what it said.
Yes.
Right. And then there's a footnote that says similar cases have adopted similar rules, concluding that simple probable cause to search a home for narcotics always allows the police to forego the knock and announce. And that's what Justice Babbage asked you. Now, you're saying that it's a general rule, drugs, selling drugs, we're not talking about using, but selling, are combined with dangerousness and the possibility of destruction. Therefore, your position is, if I understand the state's position, that you can go in and do it without a knock and announce, unless in that particular case there's some circumstances that would indicate this is not a case of dangerousness or destruction. And the example that Justice Babbage gave is that, you know, the drugs were in the barn, hidden in hay stacks, and then, therefore, it wasn't going to be destroyed. Whether it was dangerous, I don't know in that case. But so that, how then do you get to your rule? And then they go on to say in a footnote, for it's always dangerous to ground exceptions in the social norms of a given historical fact. And then they said, while the prospect of a categorical rule was one which we alerted to in Wilson, we didn't choose to adopt it. And then they say, this is the bottom line, thus, the fact that felony drug investigations may frequently present circumstances warranting no-knock, those circumstances cannot remove from the neutral scrutiny of a reviewing court the reasonableness of the police decision not to knock and announce in a particular case. Instead, I'm reading from 1421, instead, in each case, it is the duty of a court confronted with the question to determine whether the facts and circumstances of the particular entry justify dispensing with the knock and announce requirement.
Your Honor, there obviously is a particularity requirement. It's the particularity requirement that goes along with the reasonable suspicion test.
Okay.
And I think it's particularly significant that when they cite the reasonable suspicion test on page 1422, they cite Terry v. Ohio and say, requiring a reasonable and articulable suspicion of danger to justify a pat-down search. So they're comparing the reasonable suspicion you need to make a no-knock entry, the same reasonable suspicion you need to make a frisk. Now, going back to Terry v. Ohio...
Well, that's not exactly what they're saying, because they have a CF there.
Well, I think whether they're comparing it, though, to a frisk, as opposed to the original stop, it's certainly citing Terry v. Ohio for the stop and frisk, for the reasonable suspicion. Now, in Terry v. Ohio, when the court discussed the particularity requirement for reasonable suspicion, this is in Terry v. Ohio, 392 U.S. at page 21, he said, and in justifying the particular intrusion, the police officer must be able to point to specific and articulable facts, which, taken together with rational inferences from those facts, reasonably warrants that intrusion. And when the court later talks about what's needed to be frisked at page 27, it says the officer must have reason to believe the person he's dealing with is armed and dangerous. And in determining that the officer, what the officer acted reasonably, one must give weight must be given not to his inchoate and unparticularized suspicion or hunch, but to the specific reasonable inferences which he's entitled to draw from the fact in light of his experience. And then when you get the analysis of the particular case in Terry, the officer observed the individuals walking back and forth in front of a jewelry store. Just on the basis of seeing them walk back and forth, he suspected they were committing a robbery.
Mr. Kleinmeier, let me put this into this case. Assuming that we send it back and allow the state to present evidence, and the officer gets on the stand and said, I have no particular knowledge about these people. I never met them before in my life. They're not in our rap sheets. This is the first time their name has come across, but we do know that there was these drugs. Our dog sniffed out these drugs that went there. But my suspicion we don't know the drugs or how much. But based upon my past 10 years' experience in dealing with drug dealing houses, it's a very dangerous situation for us to go in there with, if we are forced to knock first, because it's dangerous to us. And also based upon my experience, these drugs are likely to be flushed down the toilet. And furthermore, I have no reason to believe that these people aren't going to be there. Is that going to be enough?
Yes. And I cite primarily to Terry v. Ohio. I say primarily to Terry v. Ohio, again, where the officer only suspect. Here, of course, we have probable cause that there's drugs involved. In Terry, it was only reasonable, it was only reasonable suspicion that these people were going to commit a robbery. And the Supreme Court said, we can assume that if they're going to commit a daylight robbery, they're going to be armed.
The
police were not aware of any other information to negate that assumption, so they were allowed to do the frisk.
But counsel, if that's your position as set forth very accurately by Justice Bavish, if that's your position, then how does that differ from what this court said in Richards, which is you got a seller of drugs and you get them in a house or an apartment or a motel room, which is what I think at least some of those cases were, then by definition, the police can assume the possibility, suspicion, probability, you can use any words you want, that there's danger because a lot of drug dealers have guns and that the drugs can be destroyed because drugs are relatively easily destroyed, especially if it's in a packet, one can assume that they can destroy it. If that's your position, it sounds to me as if that's the same thing as a blanket rule, because the rule is drugs go with guns and disposable.
I don't think it is at all, Your Honor. First of all, this position I'm taking now certainly addresses and meets some of the primary objections the U.S. Supreme Court had to the blanket rule. The court said there the blanket rule was overgeneralized because it would permit a no-knock entry even if the police knew there was no dangerous person there,
even if they knew the drugs
were packaged such that they couldn't be destroyed. Pardon?
Where did they say that?
That's at page 1421. They said in listing their objections to the blanket rule, they said the exception contains considerable overgeneralization. For example, while drug investigation frequently does pose special risks to officers, not every drug investigation will pose these risks to a substantial degree. For example, the person may not be there, or the drugs may not, or may be packaged or in such a large quantity they couldn't possibly destroy.
So that goes to the second prong, the negating.
Right? Negating, yes.
But I still, the way that the U.S. Supreme Court characterized this court's position is that the Wisconsin Supreme Court determined that police in Wisconsin do not need specific information about dangerousness for the possible destruction of drugs in a particular case. So we don't, they're saying that our Richards holding said you don't need specific information about dangerousness, and you don't need that information in a particular case in order to dispense with the knock and announce requirement in felony drug cases. I'm having a hard time seeing how what you're suggesting differs from what they're saying we did. And
first of all, because
the first prong, forget the second.
Well, the first prong, the police officer has to be able, willing to testify. And I think we also have to keep in mind, we're talking about a test for no-knocks that apply to all crimes. Where it's, this isn't just limited to drug cases or one kind of drug case. And I think it especially makes more sense when this is put in the context of all crimes, this test. But as far as the difference between what I'm proposing now and the original and the blanket rule, the police officer has to be available and willing to testify each time as to what his experience and training and how he draws his inference. I think we also have to keep in mind when we're looking at the words specific and particular as they're used in the Richards versus Wisconsin decision, those are used in the context of the reasonable suspicion test. If you're going to require that the police have specific and particular information about a particular drug dealer in this location, and in this particular location, what you are then requiring is probable cause, which the court said wasn't. And I think to see what the court means by the word specific and particular in the context of reasonable suspicion, again, I go back to Terry v. Ohio, and the court there required, said the police must point to specific and articulable facts. Take it together with rational inferences, and then they let the officer can draw from those facts. And again, in Terry, the police officer had no idea that this individual had a gun. He had no specific information he had a gun.
Is this that under the U.S. Supreme Court case, we have to make sure that in every case, every specific case, that there's at least the officer testifying as to his general knowledge.
Yes.
And as long as we have that record, in every specific case that I saw this all the time as a circuit court judge. I mean, it was like a form book, you know. They all, in drug cases, they all destroy the drugs, and there's a possibility of dangerousness. So that's all you need, and then we're okay.
Yes, and the court said, again, at page 1422, talking about the showing that the state and the police must make, this showing is not high, but the police should be required to make it whenever the reasonableness of the no-knock entry is challenged.
Okay.
So they have to be prepared to make that at each suppression hearing.
Now, Mr. Kleinmeier, would the police have to have prior authorization for the no-knock warrant? What if they just get a search warrant and nothing changes from the point they get the search warrant to the point they knock down the door?
No problem.
So there is no need, you believe the Supreme Court has not established the need for prior authorization or intervening knowledge?
No, Your Honor, and for that I looked at the footnote at the very end of the case, footnote 7 on page 1422 of the Supreme Court's version of it. The last paragraph talks, or the last footnote talks about some states do, by statute, authorize warrant approval for no-knock entries. And it said, this practice to issue a no-knock warrant seems entirely reasonable when sufficient cause can be demonstrated. But as the facts of this case demonstrate, a magistrate's decision not to authorize a no-knock warrant should not be interpreted to remove the offender. The officer's authority to exercise independent judgment concerning the wisdom of the no-knock entry at the time the warrant's being executed.
That's the Wisconsin law under our own cases, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, even back, especially in Cleveland, where the court said, you could obtain, it would be possible to obtain warrant approval, so you still have to, police still have to be able to state that to justify the entry at the time of the entry because circumstances can't change.
Well,
even if they don't change, you don't have to have warrant approval.
What if the police know when they go into the judge's office to get the search warrant, they know that they're going to execute a no-knock warrant, and yet they do not request a no-knock warrant from the judge. Is it okay?
Yes. Again, another case I've cited often here is this Dahlia versus United States, where the U.S. Supreme Court talked about what a warrant requires, and they said the warrant doesn't require approval of the manner of entry. Another problem, frankly, I have, or pardon?
In footnote 7, they say that if there's time, they think it's reasonable that the magistrate be asked for a no-knock.
Well, I think in the context of that case, what they mean, it's okay to do that, but
yeah.
It doesn't have to be required.
That's right. I'm not debating that with you. Let me go back to the United States Supreme Court brief of the amicus brief that you rely on. And I reread Richards very carefully, and the only time the Richards opinion cites the U.S. amicus brief, it doesn't do it friendly-like. It indicates that this is in footnote 5, where it says it doesn't agree with the United States amicus brief that a no-knock is a very limited intrusion. Now, in their brief, they ask for, the United States says, that its position is that a police officer is ordinarily justified in believing, based on the fact that he has a warrant to search for drug trafficking, that advance notice would create a significant risk of violence or destruction of evidence. The reasonableness of that belief is based on the police experience in a myriad of drug trafficking. So they go on, accordingly, because execution of a drug trafficking search warrant carries a significant risk of violence and potential for destruction, it is ordinarily reasonable for police officers to dispense with a pre-entry knock and announce. Where, however, police officers know that destruction of evidence unreasonably, where the police have to know sufficient facts to make the ordinary inferences of dangerous and destruction unreasonable in a given case, they may not rely on these risks. I don't find anywhere in this opinion, when the court had before this issue, that they adopted that kind of throwover of the reasonable.
I think the Solicitor General's, or the United States amicus brief, is just simply Terry v. Ohio.
I know, but the court never did say that, and you're reading it from its citation.
Pardon me, Your Honor, where did I do that? I referred to the oral argument.
Right. You're reading that into their reference to Terry v. Ohio.
And the reasonable suspicion test as applied in Terry v. Ohio.
I don't know counsel, but the justices wanted you to discuss other issues. So I'm sorry if we went over that 15-minute time that I had given you. Would you discuss those?
Okay. A couple of the issues raised in the context of this particular petition for review was that the Court of Appeals reversed it, applying the Richard versus Wisconsin test. And so one of the things that's in this, there's a concern here that applies not to this case, but to any search that would have been conducted relying on Stevens test between February of 1994 when Stevens decided and the spring of this year when Richard versus Wisconsin decided. And that is, what happens, what are we going to do to all those searches where the police relied on that blanket rule to make a no-knock entry? And I was thinking, the initial argument I think the state would consider making is a good faith argument. But in other words, applying a good faith exception exclusionary rule because the police would have relied on this court's decision. But a good faith exception assumes that the exclusionary rule applies. And I don't think that's an assumption that the state's willing to make. Because looking, I just want to quote two sentences from United States or Segura versus United States versus Segura. The point being that you don't suppress evidence unless it's the fruit of the illegal conduct. The court there said, our cases make clear that evidence will not be excluded as fruit unless the illegality is at least the but-for cause of the discovery of the evidence. Suppression is not justified unless the challenged evidence is in some sense the product of illegal government activity. Now, in the case where you have one of these no-knock entries, if it's illegal, when the police are acting on a search warrant upon which they're entitled to rely, the only thing that's illegal is not the entry, it's the failure to announce. So under this standard, the only evidence that should be suppressed is evidence that's the product of the failure to announce. So if you cannot, in order to suppress the evidence, you have to be able to say, but for the failure to announce, the police would not have seized the evidence. Now, in these cases, the only thing that would prevent police from securing the evidence under the warrant is if the people inside destroy the evidence. In Segura, the court disposed of that, saying there's no constitutional protection to the person's right to destroy evidence. So when the only fault here is the failure to announce, and that's the only constitutional violation, is a failure to announce, then I think you can only suppress evidence the police sees as a result of that failure. One example of that is Ramirez's case cited in our briefs. This situation is not so unique. I mean, it's not unique. There's other situations where the court, in a single search, recognizes that some evidence is the product of legal police conduct, other evidence the product of illegal conduct, and the court in those situations only suppresses the product of the illegal conduct. One example we've cited is where you have the police who go with a valid search warrant but exceed the scope of that warrant. The court has said the evidence seized pursuant to the execution of the valid warrant is admissible. The evidence found when the police exceed the scope, that's inadmissible.
Counsel, has Wisconsin yet adopted this good faith approach?
Well, at the moment I'm not arguing good faith, but no, Wisconsin has not yet adopted good faith.
Why should we?
Well, when it gets to good faith, first of all, this is a technical argument by which I don't think the court really has much discretion in this context, because the only challenge here is to the failure to comply with the rule of announcement, a Fourth Amendment violation. There's been no claim that Wisconsin Constitution has been violated. In fact, this court has never held that the rule of announcement is required by the Wisconsin Constitution, compliance with the rule of announcement is required by the Wisconsin Constitution. So if we're only dealing with Fourth Amendment, then this court, under Oregon versus Hoff and some other cases, is bound by the U.S. Supreme Court's application of the Fourth Amendment. The U.S. Supreme Court in Leon and in Kroll and Evans has applied a good faith exception, and I think the rationale of those cases certainly apply to decisions of this court. In Leon, it was a decision of a single judge who issues a search warrant. In Kroll, it was the legislature. If the police rely on the legislature, then what they do, you won't suppress it. And in Evans, it was a records keeper. But I think the rationale, particularly of Leon and the Kroll cases, would indicate that you should apply a good faith here. If the police have made a no-knock entry in reliance under the rule of State versus Stevens or State versus Richards, as the court made clear in Kroll, the exclusionary rule is aimed at the people who make the decision. In that case, the decision was made by this court. It was a blanket rule. And the exclusionary rule is not aimed at judges, it's aimed at police. So if the police, when executing a search warrant authorized by a single judge, or in doing a search authorized by the legislature as a Kroll, if they're entitled to rely on single judges and legislatures, I certainly think they're entitled to follow the ruling of their state Supreme Court. And this applies whether the individual officer had it in mind or not. It's an objective test that these cases make clear, whether the officer can objectively, reasonably rely. And for that, you look to what the average reasonable police officer would be aware of.
I realize your time is up. I have one question. The defense argues here that this is a unconstitutional anticipatory warrant. In other words, in anticipation, based on the facts of this case where there was a postal inspector who saw the package, went through the routine of having the dog sniff, why wouldn't it? And then, of course, the warrant was issued with the, quote, expectation that the package was going to be delivered. Why isn't this an unconstitutional anticipatory warrant?
Well, they argue it's unconstitutional because the warrant didn't set conditions on when the officers could execute the warrant. It didn't specify that the officer had to wait until after it was
delivered. Should it have done that?
No, it shouldn't. And for authority, we cite the Seventh Circuit's decision on Leitner, where they said that the conditioner, setting conditions on it are not constitutionally required. All that's required is probable cause. Probable cause can be shown by showing one method of probable cause, showing that the item is on a sure course to the address specified in the warrant. Basically, I think the language of the defendant's brief is admitted to the sheriff's course, and we have cited cases which indicate when the package is addressed to the location, it's in the possession of the authorities, the government, that provides a probable cause that it's on the sheriff's course and provides the necessary probable cause to satisfy the constitutional requirements for the warrant.
Counsel, one quick question. As a representative of the Attorney General's office, don't you want us to reach this third issue regardless of how we decide the first two?
Yes, I think it would certainly be good for guidance for those cases that are going to be decided, you're going to have to be addressing, which is versus Wisconsin now.
But you won't need them.
Pardon?
You won't especially need them if we give you the exceptions you've requested.
If the state were to win the appeal in this case on one of the first two, this court would not have to reach that last issue in this case. It's going to get here eventually, certainly, but it would not have to reach in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Mr. Hahn, you represent Tory Meyer.
Thank you. My name is Richard Hahn. I'm from Sheboygan. I represent Tory Meyer. First of all, addressing the issue raised by the state somewhat toward the end of its argument, I don't agree with the state that this issue was not premised and brought before the trial court on the state constitutional grounds. It was specifically stated in the motion, although there wasn't a lot of focus in the argument. And in light of the fact that this court has, in some cases, decided cases in, for lack of a better term, lockstep with the federal interpretation, that has not been focused upon, but it was raised in the trial court.
What section of the Wisconsin?
Article 1, Section 11. To focus on the first issue which the court desires to hear about, I would indicate that I somewhat agree with the tenor of the questioning posed to the state. I do believe that the state, in its argument, in its oral argument, and premised in its brief, is arguing for a return to the pre-Richards v. Wisconsin standard. And what we're going to have in the future is we're going to have police officers making statements to the court at suppression hearings, giving general factors, and relying upon their general experience with drug dealing and offenders who are associated with drug dealing, and we're going to end up with the same standard that we had in State v. Richards and State v. Stevens. I do believe that under the circumstances and the way that the law has developed through the United States Supreme Court and this court, that something additional is required. And I do believe that there are some specific and articulable facts which should be related in each such case to the offender who is targeted by this investigation. And I think that's almost hearkening back to this court's decision in State v. Cleveland. We do need reasonable suspicion merely because we require something more than general descriptions, a blanket rule, in other words. I don't think we're exceeding the standard of reasonable suspicion.
Mr. Hahn, why don't you give us some examples of what you're talking about?
Officer, either through an affidavit or through his own personal knowledge, recites to a magistrate that I have contact with this individual who's targeted in this investigation, who in the past I know has had a weapons offense. In addition, I know this person to be a drug dealer, which of course is not all we can rely upon, but he has had contact with weapons in the past. Consequently, I believe he may be dangerous.
You said that you knew that somebody had seen a gun in the house, even though this guy is nonviolent. Wouldn't that be enough?
I don't think that would be enough under the circumstances, but that would be the type of evidence that could be considered in scrutinizing whether reasonable suspicion has been met. Now, in further...
What if the officer testifies that he's been engaged in 25 search warrants involving drug dealing in the past, and in 24 of them, weapons were found? Is that enough?
I don't think so, because I think that would harken back to the blanket rule. I think we had some specific information targeted at this individual or the resident at this home that's targeted. I think that might then get our foot in the door.
You would require particularized knowledge as to particular individuals.
I believe that's what Richards v. Wisconsin calls for.
So in this case, when they had a package that was addressed to this specific address, 1033 St. Clair, and a drug dog who has had 36 out of 36 successful sniffs, so to speak, sniffed this out, and the fact that a postal inspector who has done this several times was familiar with this pattern, and that the detective had over 100 of these, you would say that there would not be?
I strongly believe that in this case there is not enough evidence to support evidence of drug dealing whatsoever. In this case, we have an unusual paucity of evidence.
In this case?
Where it's omitted is the fact that all we essentially have in this affidavit is a recitation by a postal inspector that he saw a suspicious package, and...
Well, the drug, the dog smelled drugs.
Yeah,
I'm getting to that.
And it was addressed to Mr. Meyer.
Correct. And the drug dog was brought in by the local authorities. He identified the package. There's no description of the package. We don't know if this is a 2-ounce package or a 300-pound package.
You think it could be for use, not sale?
Exactly. That's one of the points that the defendant made.
Let's return to the weight probable cause and back to Richard's discussion. I can understand your example about wanting specific information vis-a-vis the dangerousness of the suspect. And that's possible. Now, I've seen this person use a weapon before. I'm having a hard time envisioning anything but general assertions regarding the other concern, destruction of evidence. What kind of testimony, let's say there's no concern about safety, and the concern is only about destruction of evidence, and that's why they want a no-knock. What kind of specific showing do you anticipate?
Well, I think it would be very difficult to come up with an example of specific showings regarding that prong. I think that could only be met with more generalized...
We had a case where the police officer testified that the informant said there were buckets of some chemical around the apartment and that you could drop in packets of drugs into this bucket that would cut the drugs so that they would not produce evidence. Wouldn't that be enough? Well, suppose it was this was a big package, size of a paper, that a paper comes in and it's a huge package. One might assume that they couldn't be so easily disposed of. It's a small package, you could assume they could be flushed in seconds.
So certainly, and in addition to that, officers may have a specific piece of information regarding the type of drug that this person is identified in possessing with a more sinister intent. And if it's cocaine, of course, that may be a type of drug that's more likely to be disposed of quickly because it's held in smaller amounts. If it's bales of marijuana, if that is the basis for the reasonable suspicion, obviously the destruction could not occur as easily.
Suppose the officer announces, this is the police department, I have a search warrant, open up, and immediately after that he hears the toilet flush. Two or three times. Does he have to wait any longer than the first flush?
Well, I think that's a situation that's very similar to Richards v. Wisconsin, where I believe Mr. Richards quickly tried to absent himself from the situation, and as the concurrence indicated in State v. Richards, that in and of itself was probably a basis to dispense with the knock and announce.
Well, he had already known. He'd already been advised in Richards that it was the police, and he didn't let him in, so... U.S. Supreme Court said they could barge it down. Well, suppose this was a charge of receiving stolen goods, and there was a search warrant, and the officer testifies that this is a hunting community and 90% of the houses have guns on basis of experience in the community, having lived in the community. Do you think that he has to knock before he enters?
No, I don't believe that the mere possession of weapons in and of themselves would be enough to allow officers to dispense with a knock and announce rule without some other information which would bolster their argument to allow the court or the officers to make an on-the-spot determination.
You'd have to say, the officer would have to say, gee, he's hot-tempered, that he's a hot-tempered guy. Never been known him to be violent, but I know him to be hot-tempered, and he's got 12 guns. They're all ready for deer hunting or turkey hunting, and I therefore think that I won't knock.
Well, obviously that would be factored into the determination as to whether there's a reasonable suspicion, but the conclusory comment, he's hot-tempered, should cause a magistrate to think twice, I would think, about allowing a knock-and-announce to be dispensed with in that situation.
Counsel, you raised an issue that you thought that the affidavit did not support a finding of probable cause that there was drug dealing going on in the house.
That's correct.
But is that a necessary predicate for this search warrant? I mean, the search warrant merely authorizes a search. It does not authorize a no-knock search.
Correct.
And it seems to me that it's pretty clear that on the basis of what's contained in the affidavit, anyway, probable cause has been established that there are drugs on the premises. Would you concede that?
Well, I would not concede that there's probable cause to indicate that there were drugs on the premises at the time that the search warrant was executed.
But afterwards?
Afterwards, upon delivery, I would say that there would arguably be probable cause to indicate the drugs would be there.
Well, here wasn't the delivery, in all intents and purposes, up to the police. The inspector was working with the police department, and the delivery was timed to take place, obviously, at or before the execution of the search warrant. I mean, this was in the hands of the police, or at least the postal inspector.
Arguably, that's true. However, I don't see what, and I've never indicated in the brief that it was on a short course to Mr. Meyer. I indicated a direct course in the brief, so I take some umbrage with that. I would indicate that I don't foresee, I could see a possibility where Mr. Meyer or Nolan was home at the time, and theoretically, like in the case of U.S. v. Riccardelli, he could have picked it up and signed for it. So it's difficult to envision that situation, but I certainly think it is possible. Now, focusing on the search warrant somewhat and getting back to the previous issue which I was asked about, I would indicate that it's a somewhat unusual search warrant in that it does indicate that officers can see search for other items used either in the consumption of said illegal controlled substances or the distribution of said controlled substances. So I'm wondering right there if this was even a warrant which authorized or allowed officers, even under the state of the laws that existed at the time of the search, to search for evidence of drug dealing and therefore dispense with the knock and announce rule.
Counsel, you focus a lot of your argument on the whole probable cause, as you were discussing earlier. Let's say this court finds that there is probable cause. Do you concede then that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule should apply?
No, I don't. I think that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule has been confined to situations such as Crow, such as Evans, such as Leon, where officers' discretion is reined in to almost ministerial proportion. We have the mistaken computer record in Evans. We have the statute in Crow. We have the search warrant issued by a neutral attached magistrate. In this case, the situation that I could foresee occurring, due to the fact that judge-made law is in a greater state of flux, and I don't mean that as a criticism, but we're constantly reviewing the decisions and changing the decisions and modifying the decisions of even this court. We have a situation where there was the decision in Stevens, and then there was the decision in Wilson v. Arkansas in May of 1995. Arguably, and some members of this court, as I recall, indicated that Wilson called into question Stevens.
Well, but counsel, we have here good faith, arguably. Number one, that the police were operating under a valid warrant. And number two, an argument, that they were operating under a then valid law with Stevens and Richard. They were operating under the law that this Supreme Court fashioned, and they were operating with a valid warrant. So why shouldn't the good faith exception apply?
Because to this point, there is no case law which would allow the good faith exception to be applied to a scenario where officers are allegedly relying upon judge-made law. We have statutes where they rely upon a statute that is later determined to be unconstitutional. We have computer records which are false. We don't have judge-made law. And let me indicate why I think that's a problem. The reason I believe that's a problem is illustrated in this very case. And the reason it's a problem is Wilson v. Arkansas was decided approximately 6 months before this search. And as the concurrence in State v. Richards indicated, Wilson called into question the viability of Stevens. Theoretically, the officers executing this search warrant could get together prior to the search and actually make an argument about how they interpret the state of the law at the time that the search occurs.
No, but do you really expect police officers to do that?
Certainly
say,
not.
Well, Stevens does this, but Wilson, well, it was not remanded, and the U.S. Supreme Court didn't do that. So, I mean, therefore, there's a real question about Stevens. Maybe it's a 50%, maybe it's a 45%. I mean, that's not realistic.
No, it's not realistic. And that's the very reason that this court should reject the opportunity, the invitation to establish a good faith exception based upon case law. And this is not a scenario which is presented in the three cases, Evans, Krell, and Leon. And therefore, that is not a reasonable suggestion by the state. And I wholly concur.
Mr. Hahn, let's assume that this court thought the idea of a good faith exception was a good one. What dangers, if any, do you see in this court adopting a good faith exception?
Well, the good faith exception in this case would be dangerous for the very reason we just discussed, and that is it gives too much discretion to officers to determine what the state of the law is at a particular point in time.
How about generally?
Well, generally, I think it gives officers the discretion to make an on-the-spot determination as to what the law is, and I think that's inherently dangerous. I think the very framers of the Constitution, in enacting the Fourth Amendment, wanted to rein in the discretion of executing officers. What the state wants us to do is expand their discretion.
It seems to me that the exclusionary rule is focused on deterring bad conduct by police. That's the basis. That's why we have the exclusionary rule. And again, I return to, we have officers here who are acting under a valid warrant and acting under the law of the state of Wisconsin at the time. So the idea of deterring police misconduct, the basis of the exclusionary rule, doesn't seem to be applicable in this case.
Well, first of all, the argument that we're addressing today is not so much premised upon whether probable cause existed in the warrant. What we're addressing right now is whether there was probable cause for drug dealing, and if there was, did the officers exercise good faith, or should this court engraft a good faith argument into the exclusionary rule? And I don't think that that is appropriate under the circumstances, because what we're doing in allowing the officers to exercise that discretion, putting it upon themselves to determine whether a no-knock is appropriate under this arguably ambiguous warrant, is allowing them to make a determination as to what the law is. And I think we should deter officers from doing that. I think that's a very good policy argument. We want our magistrates to be making the determination as to whether the law allows a knock-and-announce rule under the circumstances.
But ultimately, the police are going to have to make that determination, because they have to evaluate the circumstances at the time they enter the premises, right?
When it is required, under the circumstances, yes.
Right. So, although a warrant is desirable, the ultimate decision about no-knock is made by the police on those circumstances. And since the police had every reason to rely on Stevens, then excluding the evidence, if it turns out the police were wrong, if it turns out that way, then excluding that evidence would not deter police misconduct. Because the police acted properly.
Well, I would have to somewhat respectfully disagree with that assessment in light of the fact that I don't know what the police were relying upon when they exercised, when they executed this search warrant.
Well, you have to assume that they relied on the Stevens case, which said in drug trafficking cases, you don't have to knock. Because it's assumed that there's a high probability, let alone reasonable suspicion, that they're dangerous, armed, and that they can dispose of the goods.
Well, actually, we're not arguing the subjective good faith of the officers in this case.
I understand that.
We're really addressing an issue as to whether this court should adopt a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule based upon case law. And I think we've already addressed the possible pitfalls in that scenario. I'd like to move on briefly to the Segura-Harris issue. I think that's an important issue that deserves addressing at this point. First of all, I think that the state's argument is really contrary to Wilson v. Arkansas. I think Segura and Harris must be confined to the very, very unusual facts contained in both cases. In Segura and Harris, we actually had two separate violations, two separate Fourth Amendment violations in each case, one of which did not contribute to the acquisition of any evidence, the other of which did. And in each case, the Fourth Amendment issue that was scrutinized by the court did not result in any constitutional violation. In this case, we have a single alleged violation of Mr. Meyer's rights. And we view the single alleged violation along a continuum through its execution. And we determine that the execution is constitutionally invalid, then we must suppress the evidence as a result of that violation. In Segura, clearly we had a case where the police secured the residence, but were in the process of getting a warrant. They got a warrant that was based upon probable cause and then obtained the evidence. The violation of the illegal warrantless search didn't result in any acquisition of evidence. That's a completely distinct situation from the case at bar. I would also indicate that the state's argument regarding redacting, similar to the state v. Knoll scenario, would be inappropriate. In this case, we do not have a warrant or an execution which is overly broad, where some evidence is properly obtained and some not. We have a situation where the violation taints the balance of the execution. So I think that invitation should also be rejected. Finally, regarding the anticipatory search warrant issue, there is, as counsel to the state was going to indicate, a division of authority regarding anticipatory search warrants. We have the Ricardelli line of reasoning, and we have the Leitner line of reasoning from the Seventh Circuit. I would indicate in this case, regardless of which line of authority this court adopts, that this warrant is woefully deficient in light of both positions assumed by any court, in light of the fact that it does not contain a date of delivery in the affidavit or the warrant. The warrant indicates that there is property now located on the premises, and I understand there are some cases which indicate that is not particularly offensive. There is no delivery requirement in the warrant. Delivery wasn't even an element of the search in this case. And if you survey Ruiz and Leitner and all these other cases, there is no warrant that would match the deficiencies of the warrant in this case. So regardless of which line of authority this court adopts, I think that this warrant is deficient. Appreciate the court's attention. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kleinmeier.
On the first issue we addressed about how you apply the reasonable suspicion test, counsel says he wants to go back to the test in Cleveland, or this should be applied like the test in Cleveland, but Cleveland applied a probable cause test. The language used there was reasonable cause, but this court in three cases back in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s said in Wisconsin reasonable cause means probable cause. So we can't go back, because going back to Cleveland is too far. That's probable cause. The Supreme Court said you only apply reasonable suspicion. And as to how you apply that, again, I'm going to point as one example, the State versus Guy, where this court cited a Harris case from, I think it was North Carolina. And in that particular case, the police officer justified a frisk by saying, when we do these kind of cases, we find weapons 85 to 98% of the time. And the court there said, this is precisely the kind of information that Terry talks about as far as being able to draw inferences from in light of the current facts, and draw the inferences based on experience. As far as the evidence in this case, there was a statement that there's no description of the package. That's wrong. At the preliminary hearing, the officer Yost testified that he observed the package being delivered to the house. It was approximately 12 inches by 18 inches by 4 inches. And then when he talks about what he found in the house, he said he found the individuals a few minutes later sitting around a shoebox. So this is a pretty good-sized package. And besides, this is coming from California. This is for personal use. I don't think you're going to be ordering things from getting things from California. As far as the good faith exception being confined
Before you get to good faith, I want to stay on the Richards case for just a moment. As I understand your argument, Mr. Kleinmeier, it seems to me that what you're saying is that if in writing Richards, in the state of Wisconsin, we had simply added the phrase, so long as nothing in the particular case negates the suspicion, the U.S. Supreme Court would have upheld us. Is there anything?
Well, that'd be a little bit of difference, because then a burden, police wouldn't even normally have to testify unless there was some negating information, whereas okay. Richards requires they'd be ready to be able to testify in each case justify it.
So in addition, we would have had to add that the police would have to justify it based upon their experience or whatever.
In each
particular case. Anything else?
Since they can, that's no problem. It really is negated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that they have to be able to testify in each case.
Right.
So there is no blanket rule anymore. They have to justify it case by case.
But they can testify in every case on the basis of the experience we know from prior cases.
Your Honor, during the argument in Richards, one of the Supreme Court justices, Justice Souter, said, well, why does the state even need the blanket rule? Because in virtually every case, they're going to be able to make a no-knock entry. And the Attorney General said, well, what you're stating then is the Solicitor General's position, and the response was, was yes. I mean, so obviously just one justice during oral argument. I realize that doesn't necessarily the holding. But to put this test, if you want to put it more significantly, think of it in other crimes. I mean, in drug dealing, we have all this experience cited in all kinds of cases about the danger of drugs and weapons. So it might be relatively easy, as indicated by the justice during the oral argument in this case, to justify the no-knock in drug cases. In many other cases, though, it's going to be much more difficult for the police officer to get to stand and say, my experience in, stealing stolen tires is that there's danger of destruction of evidence.
But we specifically limited Richards to only cases involving drug dealing.
Richards was limited, but this test in Richards versus Wisconsin is not. This test in Richards versus Wisconsin applies to the execution of all search warrants.
The one up at the big
one. Yeah, Richards v. Wisconsin.
Yeah,
to justify a no-knock in any search case, whether it's drugs or anything, the police have to have this satisfy this reasonable suspicion test. So it's broader than that.
Let me tell you what's bothering me, and that is I look at the U.S. Supreme Court case. It's 9-0. I look at the footnote that says 26 attorney general's offices and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico and Guam filed amicus briefs. I mean, they took enough initiative to file amicus briefs to say that the holding, as was characterized in the opinion, that the holding of the Supreme Court of Wisconsin case in Richards was incorrect in determining that police in Wisconsin do not need specific information about dangerousness or the possible destruction of drugs in a particular case in order to dispense with no-knock. So you've got 9-0, you've got 26 plus saying that was wrong, and you're saying the only thing we have to do different To change that is the statement that every officer, when they go in, should say, and there's nothing to negate in these fact situations the reasonable suspicion.
First of all, those 26 states took the position I'm taking right now. And I'm not minimizing what the Supreme Court said, because the Supreme Court acknowledged that frequently this is going to be justified in drug cases. They said the police officer's showing is not high. It's only reasonable suspicion, not probable cause.
So that's the only thing we need, and everything would be different if we had an officer say the 15 words or whatever it is. Nothing in this case negates the reasonable suspicion. Seven words. Okay.
Well, he or she's going to have to explain what their experience or training which justifies that. But I mean, again,
they don't have to rely on their experience. They can say, I've read in the book that drugs and guns go together.
Well, Your Honor, again, that's basically again the response from the justice during the oral argument. And what the Supreme Court was concerned about was, if you're going to have a blanket rule for drug dealing, are you going to have a blanket rule for murders and armed robberies and stuff?
I gather you think that there's a blanket rule from Terry that if the guy is casing a joint and they think that it's robbery, that they have, in daylight, they can assume that it's armed.
Unless there's information negated, that's exactly what they say.
That's the general rule that would be applicable everywhere.
That's what they say in Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. The court is in recess until 1:45. The students from Lincoln High School, Columbus High School, and Tri-County High School.